Hello, I'm Keith Jopling from The Song Sommelier, and you're listening to The Art of Longevity. Brett Anderson from Suede once said that successful artists have all followed a similar journey, comprising four stages: the struggle, the stratospheric rise to the top, the crash down to the bottom, and then the renaissance. We'll reflect on the learnings, wisdom, battle scars, and wounds of major artists that have been decades in the music business and ask, what really defines success? It's a question many fans and fellow musicians and aspiring musicians want to know the answers to. We find out on The Art of Longevity. Niall Rogers, welcome to The Art of Longevity.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining me, Niall. How are you and whereabouts in the world are you?
I am actually very well, and I'm in a town called Westport, Connecticut.
I was doing some homework on you recently, and I listened to your appearance on the Rock on Tours with Martin Kemp. I mean, that was quite recent. You said you'd recorded 100 songs. No, you'd written 100 songs in the lockdown period.
Yes.
What are you going to do with 100 songs? What's the plan?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. Many years ago, I met Maestro Ennio Morricone. He was doing a concert tour in America, which was unusual for him. And he just said to me, we were backstage, and he said to me, Nile, just write every day. Write every day. Yeah. And he says, even if you don't have a specific job in mind, if you don't have a project that you're working on, just write, because you're a composer and you'll have different motifs and different ideas that just come to you organically. So just put those down. And it's Ennio Morricone. What are you going to say? No. So I started doing something like that, writing all the time. And what's been interesting is that in today's world, it's become a little bit more convenient for me because I could just take my voice recorder and put down a little motif or two or whatever. Whereas in the old days, I used to have to write everything down on manuscript paper. Somehow, when you commit to doing it like this, it becomes internalized a little deeper. Like when I actually do notation, I have a better memory. Or maybe it's just I'm older. I don't know. But what I wind up having, though, is a collection of motifs and ideas that when I hear them now are really fresh to me. I go back and go, oh, I understand the cleverness or whatever it was that inspired me to write that. And because they haven't been internalized, they feel fresh and new to me. So maybe that's why or how I've written the songs. Then you meet different artists along the way and you play little ideas for them and they can develop. If they're projects that they're working on, if they have albums that they're going to release within a year or whatever, and the circumstances are always different. I have a lot of ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess getting those ideas down is critical for you. In fact, I remember, I think I heard you saying in an interview once that you always hear music in your head. I guess that's a good thing for us because we've benefited from the fruits of that. But it must be kind of an odd thing to live with. So you have to get it out of your head and onto paper, I guess.
Man, you just said so much. Yeah, I always hear music. I have to constantly distract myself. And something interesting happened on our last tour a little over a year ago. We were flying into Belgium. It was a landing. I don't know. Somehow the pressure built up in my ear, and I had fluid in my I get not the semicircular canal, but you know, fluid in this part of your ear. I forget what the in the eustachian too. And after that, I had a couple of bouts of vertigo, and then I developed tinnitus. So now I have a continuous tone in my ear. Besides the musical ideas, it's so annoying and so difficult to live with that I always have to have other oral distractions. So I have television going on all the time. It's annoying, but it also can be a resource because I hear it and I can.
Yeah, a recording studio is not a bad place to be. You know,
it's a strange existence now. So I've always had the music playing in my head, and that's just I think that it's a coping mechanism that I developed when I was a kid because I was very lonely and I used to score my life. So you know, if I reached for something, I went and it just became a thing.
I mean, you're the perfect guest for this show in so many ways. You know, your 5-decade plus career and ups and downs and roundabouts. Hopefully I'm going to ask you some questions you don't get asked that often, but I feel like the right place to start is very familiar territory, which is back in 1982 when you went into the Continental Club in New York and you saw David Bowie there and you got into a conversation with Bowie about, I think, about the jazz greats, which you connected over despite Billy Idol barfing in the background. And one thing led to another. You did Let's Dance, and you turned it from what was a folk song into the song we all know. What the question I want to ask you, because Bowie lined that up for you by saying he wanted an album of hits. And you've said, even in your own words, you've said that was coming off the back of, I think, 6 flops, in your own words.
Yeah, I think it was 5 flops.
Yeah, who's counting? Can you remember or recall just the, did you feel pressure? How did you cope with the pressure of that environment?
What's really amazing about that is that I didn't feel any pressure at all. The Let's Dance album was the easiest album I've ever made in my entire career. And I think the reason why I didn't feel any pressure was twofold. One, because I had just had 5, or maybe 6, you could be correct, failures in a row. And those failures didn't necessarily propel my life forward. But if I had a failure with Bowie, the interesting thing was is that I believe that it would still have propelled my life forward because it would have given me artistic credibility that it seemed having big pop records had escaped me for some reason. Though even though I had so much success and I had from my first single that I put out, every record was a hit until the summer of 79. So I had that gap of, I did have a big hit, of course, in 1980 with Diana Ross. So, but my own band, Chic, we never had another hit after Good Times. And so for that 2-year period between Diana Ross and that album had a great long life because we had 2 really big singles, but the album was very, very solid. So I thought that if I had a failure with Bowie, the difference between having a failure with, you know, the artists that I failed with, you know, Debbie Harry going on a solo career, and, you know, and other projects that I had done, Bowie had never really had a big record, except I guess Young Americans at that time was the biggest record of his life. And that was considerably earlier than when I came on board. He had just come off of an album called Scary Monsters. And unbeknownst to me at the time, he was dropped from his label. So he had no label and I was about to be dropped. So there was no, right. There was no place to go but up. Like, you couldn't go any further down. Both of us having no labels. But if the record was financed by a Bowie and put out by David, even if we were totally indie, something like that would have had a huge amount of credibility just on the artistic scale. So I was fine. And then when he told me that he wanted to do hits, well, hits, believe it or not, and I don't mean this in an egotistical way at all, but hits seem to be my natural comfort zone. Like, I naturally wanted to do music that appealed to the masses. So when he asked me to do that, even though I was sort of gobsmacked, because I thought, wow, you're just coming off of Scary Monsters. Why do you want to do a complete 180? Obviously, to me, that's the artistic vibe you're in. Let's just do another Scary Monsters, like part two, and then I'll be that cool artistic guy with a flop, and it'll be great.
I mean, the amazing thing is there is still some weirdness on that album. I mean, you've got stuff Ricochet on there, and you know, it's not all full of hits. But
Let's Dance is weird because
Let's Dance to me is the complete song, not just the single edit that became popular. So it started with this wacky
pocket trumpet, you know, freestyling and stuff like that. And then in the long version, the actual full version of Let's Dance, there's a whole battle between the sax and, you know, it's not your typical pop song.
We just were able to edit it in a way that was nice and poppy.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you this question later, actually, but I think maybe it fits better now, because you're right. There's a lot going on in that song. It's not obvious, but you knew there was something to it. Like when you'd finished it, you know, everybody there on the scene knew that was going to be a hit. But, you know, as a virtuoso player with Bernard and the band, once you got into the studio, I mean, I'm not saying Bowie's not a virtuoso, but he probably isn't. But when you got into the studio with musicians as virtuosos, you also just had an ear for what was going to work as a pop song. And that strikes me as being something that's incredibly difficult to do. How did that happen?
So the interesting thing about working with incredibly proficient musicians are, I guess it's being able to be a good orchestrator and a good band leader and have them follow the discipline of the composition. Like, I don't need you to do the thing that you always do that's so amazing and fantastic. What I do need you to do is follow the discipline of what I've written on the paper. And everybody that I've ever worked with has been able to do that. And then when we allow people to just go off and be great, Let's Dance is a perfect example. Stevie Ray Vaughan didn't look at any charts when he played. I don't know if Stevie could even read music. Matter of fact, I know he couldn't, because I produced him later on. So Stevie's virtuosity was just natural from the heart. He could just hear great. So the foundation of the record, though, is that, you know, the great rhythm section, those players that could stick to what I had written and also make it their own. And that's what, you know, virtuosos can do. That's why we like, you know, people who are superstar soloists, because they can take a composition that you know and
make it their own, or they can play something new that you've never heard before, and you're just dazzled with their power of interpretation and, you know, and sometimes their dexterity and virtuosity.
Well, as you said, you working with Bowie, whatever the outcome was going to take you forward, I guess it took you into territory that, I don't know, maybe you didn't expect it at the time, because I know you've worked with Diana Ross immediately after Chic, and then after Bowie, you really did become, you entered the realm of pop with just amazing success. And it was, I want to just pause on Original Sin, because that was the first time, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you worked with a band that was essentially unknown, or what you like to call a kind of an opening act, which was Incubus.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who then went on to become huge. And then actually you started to do that, transform careers from an early stage.
Right.
How did Original Sin come about? Just tell me a little bit about that process as well.
So very quickly, I was working with a band who was fairly unknown, but they were known in Canada, especially Toronto, where they're, you know, which was their home base. And they were called Spoons. And I saw Spoons because they were opening for Culture Club. And I was just really interested in Spoons because for some reason they had a vibe that I liked. So I went up to Toronto to produce Spoons. And while I was up there, U2 was performing and Hall & Oates were performing at some kind of festival. And it was the first time I saw U2, first time I even heard of U2. I went there and I was completely enthralled. They were amazing. Bono was climbing up the lighting truss and it was just incredible. And then I went out to see another band that was part of this festival going on, but they were in a smaller venue. I went there and the band was Incubus. I had never heard of them. And when I went to meet the band backstage, they started singing a song from my solo album, which was a complete flop, which was the lead single from my solo album, my first solo album, total flop. And they had organized it in 4 or 5 part harmony. And they were singing it backstage and it was beautiful. And they said that they used that to warm up with. And I thought to myself, boy, talk about making a first impression. That was unbelievable. They were like, I mean, they had it down. They said, yeah, we do this every single night. I couldn't believe that they had taken this obscure record of mine and now they were performing it every day at Soundcheck. So they asked me to work on, I don't know if they asked me to work on their album or even just one song. Maybe they were closing in on the end of their album. But at some point, I wound up with them at Electric Lady Studios, where I've done a lot of historical great things in my life. My first Chic single was done there. Daft Punk, Get Lucky was done there. Original Sin was done there. Hall & Oates, Adult Education was done there. You know, a lot of things that were big in my life. So I'm at Electric Lady with these guys, and I noticed that one of the most unique things was going on is the drummer had a sound on his bass drum that was really cutting, and I just loved it. I was like, damn, what is that? And I was just enthralled with the drum sound. I was like, wow, this dude is totally great. So I'm thinking about that, and they're playing the song for me. And they're singing the song down and, you know, I'm either writing out a chart or learning it. And I remember they started singing, they got to the chorus, and the chorus at the time was Dream on White Boy, Dream on White Girl, Dream on Black Boy, Dream on Black Girl, and Wake Up to a Brand New Day. And I thought to myself, well, I looked upon my own life experiences and my stepfather is white. And I always remembered when I was a kid, my stepfather being white, my mom being black, always was a head turner. And they were a fabulous couple, but it was, you know, it was odd, even in New York City, even in Greenwich Village. We lived in the hippest part of New York. But I thought that I knew what the guys were going for. And I said, why don't we just make it just one step more controversial? Or and I look at these type of things as artistic because you could actually make a bigger statement. The band loved the idea. I didn't have to convince them at all. They were like, wow, okay, cool. So they changed the lyric to what I had suggested, and then I called Daryl Hall from Hall & Oates and asked him to come down and sing background vocals with us. Because in those days, we all worked on everybody's records. I mean, if you look at the credits on the back of my records, you'll see lots and lots of big stars working with me just in sidemen type positions, even though they're, you know, superstars, especially from the jazz and classical world. So when I asked Daryl to come down and sing with the guys, it just was magical. Everything seemed to work. We, you know, that's a one take song. Because of that wooden beater, he burst the drum head like right at the end of the song. So we, you know, now at this point it was nighttime, all the music shops were closed, and we went and we listened, and we thought the take was great, and it was done. It was like, well, we don't need to do this again, even though I believe we probably tried to redo it. I can't swear to that because most of my records are pretty much one take recordings. You know, we rehearse it, and then we do it. And when we finally like it, we don't need to hear another one or record another one.
I love your kind of self-made belief systems. And one of those is the DHM, right? So the deep hidden meaning. So is that what you meant with the dream on?
Yes, absolutely.
You got that deep hidden meaning. And then also the wooden beater, right? This is like you've created so many sounds. And those little sounds seem to have made the difference.
Yeah, that's sort of the to me, that's the thing that makes music interesting. And you probably can apply this to any art form or even any job. If you have a problem to tackle and you find the solution, this is just my way of looking at it. As a producer, every day I have a problem. Like today, when I finish with you, I have a bunch of problems that I have to solve that have all been mounting up over the last few months. Because, you know, I sort of paint myself into a corner, and then now you have to work your way out of it.
Yeah.
So when I start to hear these sounds, I mean, I don't know why I called Daryl Hall. They sounded great. I mean, the guy sounded fantastic. Maybe I just called Daryl because I knew that he had something in his voice that would blend with Michael and the guys. Like, I don't remember, but I just knew that was important to me as a sound. Like, I knew the sound of Daryl's voice because I had worked with them. I did, I wound up doing, a film soundtrack later on with them, Earth Girls Are Easy, which wound up being my first time working with B-52s. Yeah. Just one thing in my life would lead to the next. And so at that point now, Hall & Oates were in my life. I wound up doing adult education with them. All sorts of stuff was going on. And, you know, when you have a problem to solve, you say, let me get the guy with the wooden beater, or let me get the guy with this voice, or let me get the woman.
That's part of solving a problem, is you get the person in to help you solve the problem. And it's just interesting to hear you frame what you do as problem solving. I don't think that's obvious to people.
It's 100% my job.
Well, look, after Original Sin, I know that Duran Duran were a fan of that record, and they were a fan of what INXS was doing. So they then reached out to you. And I'm interested in your relationship with Duran Duran for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, first of all, Notorious is for me one of my top 10 records. But you had a long relationship with them. It sort of spanned, first of all, those singles, you know, from The Reflex, I think, was the first single, then into the Notorious album, then it continued on. Many years later, you worked on them with Astronaut and so on. And you've talked about your joy in working with those guys a lot. So what was it that you enjoyed so much? Was it about bringing them on to be better musicians, or was it because it was fun? Or was it the outcome that you enjoyed? What aspect is it that you enjoy working with them?
So here's something that I really never talk about. So from the first moment I met the guys in Duran Duran, we really hit it off. I mean, it was the same kind of thing. It was because they liked what I had done artistically, right? So they were fans of mine, but I was also a fan of theirs. And, you know, and I loved all their songs, all the singles from the first record. And I just thought it was great stuff. But they didn't have the respect in the industry. And I couldn't understand why, you know, the critics sort of were so down on them. And I kept thinking, I mean, these are great songs, Planet Earth and Girls on Film and Rio. I mean, these are great, great, great songs. Why is a group like, you know, U2 considered more artistic than Duran Duran? Like, I felt weird. So I wanted to try and give them artistic credibility. And once again, that's totally not coming from an egotistical place. That's coming from me being a worker bee and trying to solve a problem, trying to, you know, build a nest or a hive, or, you know, fill the hive with honey or something. So I you left out a really important record with Duran Duran, the Wild Boys.
Yes.
Wild Boys. So the first thing I did with them wound up being their biggest single of their whole career. And that was cool because they were sort of on a roll. And when I redid the Reflex, it's artistically to them spoke to that thing that was missing, that element that was missing in Duran Duran. So I felt like I was just a new member of the band. Yeah. And I threw in my two cents and my ideas. Go to the Wild Boys, though, that song and that single had to stand on its own because it was the only new song on a compilation album. And that new song had to propel that compilation album. So I thought, here's the opportunity for Duran Duran to really stretch out and artistically be more, I guess, sort of in the footsteps of the Bowie.
And for a pop single, even at that time, it was wild. It was just full of innovation, right? It's a little bit crazy.
Yeah, yeah. But it worked, though. It really wound up working.
I mean, I'm just speaking as one fan, but I'm a lifelong fan, and I'm very much hoping they'll come on to this show as well. So you drew me in with that string of projects. So the Reflex, I thought, was the first song I heard that, okay, wasn't just a single for, you know, teenage girls. This is going back when I was a teenager. Wild Boys, I heard it and saw the video, of course, and just thought, okay, wow, that's a good song. And then with Notorious, there was something else going on, which just, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but it had the Nile Rodgers signature all over that record.
So Notorious, the reason why that was so important to me and the band was, now I have a relationship with a band that's incredibly successful and two of the members leave the band. Like, what are you guys doing? What's, you know, like, you're falling apart at the apex of your career. Like, this makes no sense. So now I have to be psychologist, best friend, composer, orchestrator, all that sort of stuff, and hanging out partner. I mean, this was the days of, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And, you know, we were pretty into that. I mean, it was pretty, we were wild boys. And, but still, I had to keep my eye on the ball. I couldn't let that become the driving force of the record. So imagine you have a lot of internal conflict, a lot of external pressure to succeed, because a record label now has, if you think of it almost like a commodity. So the record company has this commodity that really is very valued. They certainly don't want the value of that thing to go down. They want it to go up. So I had to be aware of that. I wasn't aware of it really from the record company's point of view, but I was certainly aware of it from the brand Duran Duran's point of view. And of course, my own inner desire to lift them up to a new artistic place. That album to me is amazing. Winter Marches On just still makes me cry every time I hear that song.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you're right. I mean, with Winter Marches On, it's, you know, it's pretty dark. And you've got things like The Proposition on there that's quite rocky. Yeah, it goes all over the place, but I love it so much. Now, during that time as well, Nard was working with elements of Duran Duran. So he produced A View to a Kill and The Power Station. And you were doing your work on Notorious. Did you compare notes together? Did you advise each other, or were you at that time a little bit more separate?
Not at all. We were really it's interesting that our situations kind of mirrored each other. So even though Bernard and I, since the first day we met, had developed this sort of lifelong friendship, but because of drugs and internal pressure and external pressure, we had drifted apart artistically. So we didn't collaborate. We didn't compare each other's projects while we were working on them. You know, sadly, but it was the right thing to do. Bernard only played on one song on the Bowie album, but I couldn't think of doing an artist as important as David Bowie and not having the essence of Chic on that album. So, but you know, we both had really bad drug problems, but I was able to suppress them for 2 weeks. You know, the album Let's Dance only took a little over 2 weeks to make. So I just had to stay sober and together for about 17 or 18 days, which I was able to do. And I delivered that album in 17 days. The 18th day, I went out and party. So when it came time to Duran working with both Bernard and myself on different projects, you have to remember, Duran were huge fans of Chic. And when you talk about virtuosity, God, who's a better bass player in the world than Bernard Edwards? I mean, I've never met that person. So I've played with some awesome bass players, everybody from, you know, Marcus Miller to Jaco Pastorius to, I mean, just so many great bass players. I have never played with a bad band, but Bernard just had something that was completely unique and his own thing. And he also had great musical ideas. And I promise you, no matter what people say, that I was a major force into pushing Bernard into producing other people. You may have read somewhere about the time that I took Bernard to see Paul McCartney.
Yeah, Madison Square Garden. Yeah.
Right. In Madison Square Garden, I'm with Bernard Edwards and Chris Squire, and Paul McCartney is on stage. I'm like going, wow, I'm like, this bass collective of geniuses, and I'm sitting next to Bernard saying, like, you know, come on, man, you need to do more rock and roll. The thing that people don't quite understand is that we learned to make records in the old school way. So once hip hop became a new form of artistic expression, especially in the Black community, records were now being made in a different way. And our expertise was based on the old school way of having great musicians, you know, great players that can get things done right away. Give them the idea, here's the chart, play it, move on. Because to us, you know, tape costs money. Well, once people started to sample and those things didn't cost money, and you just bought the machine and it would live in its memory, like, wow, wait a minute. Like, that changed everything. But for us, our edge was being able to work with tape and being able to do all sorts of tricks that people that were in the digital domain now were being able to do just like that. Yeah. No problem at all. So their cleverness had to come from the analog information that they were putting on top of the samples and digital. So it was the cleverness of their rapping and their styles and their flow.
And also the way that they would cut up the various pieces of music. It's what I call collage musical art. They're just brilliant at doing that. We didn't have that kind of background. We didn't have any idea how to do it. That was not our training. But in rock and roll, they were still making records the same way we made records. Go into the studio with the band and make the record.
I find it just incredible. I mean, it's great that you encouraged, you know, Nard to get into production as well. But the fact that he went on and had similar success to you at the time. So, he, you know, he did
ABC,
Kill, ABC, The Power Station, of course, in which he played. And then Riptide, which is, I mean, from when I was listening to records as a kid, again, that record, I played it over and over and over. But it had Addicted to Love on it. And it was a popular record. It was a breakthrough for Robert Palmer.
Absolutely.
Somehow you both did it, but you did it independently.
Yeah. And he also, you know, people forget that he became very viable because he was doing records with Rod Stewart,
Jody Watley, Ronald Isaac. I mean, you know, so he developed his own thing. And I remember one of the most interesting days of my life is I was doing Mick Jagger's first solo album, and we were both working at the Power Station. The recording studio called the Power Station. So the band, the Power Station,
or the band Power Station, was working at the Power Station in the studio right next door to us. And we heard that amazing drum sound, which I was trying to get Mick into, and Mick wasn't having it. No matter how much I played, you know, Diana Ross, I'm Coming Out for Him, and saying, like, look at how cool it is to have this cool percussive drum, pop, pop, da. And then, you know, also remember Wild Boys, Wild Boy, you know, like that was the thing that was happening at that time. And probably because of Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins. So they were pioneering these gated room drum sounds.
And XTC before that.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right.
And everybody was playing big drums.
Yeah. So we tried to superimpose that on, you know, on R&B music or whatever music we were doing at the time. And it just so happened that because most of my music was still analog, though we had now, or I had now, switched over to recording to a digital format instead of cutting tape, still in the room, I was depending upon the musicians, their power of interpretation, you know, good composition and things like that. So it was still really, really old school, even though we had the newest technology. So both Bernard and I were sort of on similar paths, but just with different people.
Yeah.
And the one person you didn't mention, which was really huge in my life, was after Duran Duran, I did Madonna, Like a Virgin. Oh my God, that was, you know, I never saw anything like selling 25 million albums or, you know, with one record. I was like, are you kidding me? Nor did she, by the way. But the great thing about Madonna was that was her aim right from the beginning. She, I believe the night that we met, I asked her what she wanted to do. And she told me something like, rule the world. Most artists don't say stuff like that.
You've had some pretty big briefs over the years.
Yeah.
It seems like it's important. I mean, I don't want to be flippant about it. The way the artists tell you what they want seems to be important to you.
It's so everything. I'll give you a great example. Right now, I am working with a lot of artists, but at this exact moment, the problem that I'm trying to solve today, I'm working with an artist named Remy Wolf, and she's amazing. And I kept thinking, there is no problem to solve. You are extraordinary. You're fantastic. I love your music exactly the way it is. I don't want to touch it. And she talked me into touching it because she said that she graduated from USC College, University of Southern California. And she said they had a course there that she took called The Music of Nile Rodgers. And I was on the floor laughing. I was like, going, you got to be kidding me. There's a college that teaches the music of not, what the hell is that? It's got to be all over the map. So she was like, I studied that course. I took that course. And the first time I did something, it was horrible. And I then did some kind of jury exam and passed. And that's it. She was just focused. That's what she wanted, was Nile Rodgers in her life. And I think that you will see other stuff from Remy and myself come out in the future, because we have a relationship that's incredible. I mean, she's just 24 years old, and our bond is like that. But at the exact same time, now I'm working with Idina Menzel. And the very first conversation I had with Idina, she said something to me that I will never let her drop. Every time we talk about a song or we work virtually together and we write something, I always say to her, but remember what you told me that first day? That's what I'm trying to do. I won't tell you what it is that she said, but I always have to constantly remind her of that. And it's exactly the same formula with Bowie. Once he tasked me with making a hit album, he didn't say a hit single, he said a hit album. I was just obsessed with the concept of every song being catchy and relevant. And then, you know, like we had the fun track Ricochet where we just went nuts. And, you know, I think we wrote that in the studio in a matter of minutes. And then I went home and wrote out the string. Oh, no, I actually wrote the horn chart right there in the studio. And it was the first time I had actually heard the phrase head charts. Like I never even heard that phrase. And the horn player said to me, hey, Nile, why don't you write head charts for this? And I said, what the hell is that? They said, will you just actually give us the parts out off the top of your head? We'll all just write them down and play them. So I came up with
you just hum it out loud.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the next part would be legato. And I went, wah, 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 wah. So
I think this is part of your problem solving DNA, because it's about how people give you the brief, how they deliver in words, you know, what they want. So I'm going to skip over a criminal amount of your career, because we only have 10 minutes left, but up to the point where I think maybe there could have been two futures for Nile Rodgers. One, you know, someone always with that huge catalog, but essentially in the background somewhere, possibly, you know, even forgotten to some extent. And the one that you have now, where you're up front, you're part of music culture, modern music culture, working with new artists. It felt to me like Get Lucky was part of that process. And Daft Punk came to you with a brief and they said they wanted to make a record like the internet didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
That must have got your juices flowing.
That's all they needed to say. They came to my apartment to play some demos. And I have a really good memory, but I do not remember playing. I don't remember them playing any demos, because I don't think I even wanted to hear them, because I told them that the way I work is spontaneous. I get in the studio, I'll write out the chart real quick, and we just go. And they gave me their brief, as you call it, which I love. And once they told me that they wanted to make an album as if the internet never existed, they were speaking in what I call band logic. And I always say that band logic is never, ever to be confused with actual logic. It's the way that
musicians speak, where they're giving you the holistic story, the deep hidden meaning of what they really want.
But it's a very specific form of shorthand, that, because I guess they were communicating so much, and this was a band that were known for being electronic band in the first place, right? So
correct. So think about that. So if the internet hadn't existed, what they meant was, so the internet didn't exist, this digital technology didn't exist, so and so didn't exist, but vocoders did exist because when I was still a teenager, Walter Carlos before Walter became Wendy Carlos, you know, did Switched on Bach. And when he's doing the fugue portion of Beethoven's Ninth, he's doing that with a vocoder that he sort of invented. And it sounds amazing when you throw, and it's like incredible. I was a teenager. I was still in high school when I heard that. So everything that they said to me made perfect sense, because even though Tomas's thing was vocoder and really being brilliant with it, that did exist. The songs that I did on Random Access Memory, and I'm really feel fortunate that I'm the only co-composer that has three songs with brilliant geniuses like Def Punk, all are incredibly analog, really analog, made at Electric Lady, by the way, same place as In Excess and Hall & Oates and Cheek's first single. And if you listen to a song like Lose Yourself to Dance, that's just a trio. It's just guitar, bass, and drums. No keyboards, nothing, until Tomas comes in with the vocal and goes, come on, come on, come on, come on. But the song is just singing, you know, Pharrell on top of a funk trio.
So, I mean, to just the average walking music fan, whether you'd been around from the early days and your stuff in the 80s or not, that was the moment when I remember hearing it on the radio, and it was on the radio all the time, and it still is. It was, oh, Nile Rodgers is back. And, you know, I know you'd been busy always. You'd done film soundtracks. There was a Chic reformation in 1992. But since then, when you came back, you seem to have stayed back. Is that kind of is that by design, or did you feel like that was a pivotal moment where you wanted to be back in the, you know, in the culture?
Well, what happened was, this is going to sound completely crazy. I was going over my annual accounting to do taxes, and I had a pretty successful video game soundtrack company. And the problem was, though, is that at the time, we were so dependent upon retail, and physical product was now starting to go away. And that was not part of my original business plan. You know, the business plan was built around retail stores and people going in and seeing, oh my God, Nile Rodgers is attached to Halo and Hitman and all this stuff. So it was a new, very dedicated audience that I wanted to get into. And also, people don't quite understand that video games, as I used to say, my slogan was, video games were just as important to the music industry as supermodels, right? So if you were a big rock star, you chances are you had a supermodel girlfriend and you played video games. And I thought that these two things were really associated. So I couldn't provide people with supermodels, but I could do music for video games or be the company that distributed them. So I did that, and that was an important part of feeling connected to a new thing that was happening in the music business.
Yeah.
That gave me, I guess it gave me a sort of a refreshing new start, because I had been sober, then my partner dies, Bernard dies when we're, you know, now just starting to get Chic re-energized. And I realized that, okay, so the video game business was now starting to do poorly, the soundtrack part of it. My other businesses were doing poorly. But the one thing that I could see on my balance sheet was, the concerts were doing really well. And I thought, my God, why don't I go out and play my music? And I honestly was doing the first series of concerts as a tribute to Bernard. It was was 1 year after he had died. And the promoter asked me to come and pay tribute to Bernard in the place, in the country where he died, which was in Japan, in Tokyo. And it was huge. It was massive. It was, the concert was a sellout. We did great. And I realized, oh, my God, people wanted to hear this, even though it was in Japan. That's fine with me. And then so I started to play more live concerts. And I have to give a lot of love and a lot of credit to festivals, especially in Ireland, because we started gigging and we were certainly not headliners. But boy, if you looked at what the crowd reaction was to Sheik's early concerts in Ireland, festival, and you know these festivals, it was incredible. You would think that we were, you know, a big headliner, and I'll quickly tell you the story. I only have two reviews memorized. One was about the album Notorious, because the journal New Music Express always gave Duran Duran horrible reviews, even though their albums and songs were brilliant. But when we put out Notorious, the review came out and the reviewer said, just when you thought it was time to count these jerks out, they not only do an album that's good, but one that's worthy of respect. And I kept thinking to myself, that's all I ever wanted to see. New Music Express saying that they respect Duran Duran. Oh my God. And then we played a festival in Roskilde, and I remember seeing the review the day or so after, and I didn't know that at Roskilde they rated the bands. The first time we ever played there. And the person who wrote the review on Sheik said, oh, you know, and this was when Green Day had American Idiot out, and they were just the talk of the world. Yeah, so Green Day was headlining Roskilde, and we were playing in the DJ tent because no one knew that Sheik was an actual real band, or at least these guys who booked us didn't know that.
For all those years.
Yeah, so we were playing in the DJ tent, and the person who came to who reviewed us said, oh, after Green Day, we decided to go to the DJ tent and hear Sheik play Le Freak and Good Times.
They said,
well, Nile Rodgers proceeded to play
40 minutes of
number one records. Oh, and then he played Le Freak and Good Times.
And that was so amazing to me that I actually remember that. Like, you know, he proceeded to play 40 minutes of number one records. Oh, and then he played Le Freak in Good Times.
Well, that's a very good, again, it's a very good review. So put nicely into words, which is probably what caught your attention. But I was going to ask you about, you know, your relationship actually with the UK and Europe since the Daft Punk days, because we've really taken to Nile Rodgers, right, as a touring band, as a personality. Do you recognize that? I mean, what's your relationship with the UK, for example, as opposed to your home country?
It's actually been overwhelming, probably very similar to what jazz musicians felt in the early days of proto-jazz and jazz in France and Germany and places like that, Switzerland. I guess there was no Disco Sucks movement ever in England. As a matter of fact, when Bernard and I first heard about the whole Disco Sucks event, we were on a plane flying back from England and we're reading the newspaper and like, what is this?
Yeah, because in Britain, there was, I think, disco, not disco exactly, but Britfunk mm-hmm. was coming up. Mm-hmm. And Freeze and all of that stuff was coming into fashion.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, and I mean, just everything, all this sort of great groove music, soul to soul, and I mean, just all sorts of really cool stuff. But anyway, so I guess somehow, In the UK, our music was always relevant and fresh to people, maybe in the same way that other classic music was, you know, relevant to people, whether it's, you know, Led Zeppelin or Crosby, Stills and Nash or the Beatles or something like that. In America, that was not the case because we never really had, especially during the era of terrestrial radio, classic R&B kind of funk stations. It's now become a thing because of a great DJ, D-Nice. D-Nice has started, you know, Club Quarantine, and that's taken off like crazy. And one of my compositions is the theme song for Club Quarantine. Sister Sled song. And that's been incredible because now people in America are starting to give me props, and, you know, and also we tour in America almost exclusively. If we're not doing our own headline show or a festival, we open for Cher, which gives us a huge audience. But the UK has been incredible for us. We actually played the O2 in London twice in the same calendar year. I mean, that's like a rock band. That's like, like we play O2 twice.
Yeah, it's amazing. Look, I don't want to keep you over time, but I want to thank you for coming on and just, again, just being the perfect guest for us. But I think you remember this. Someone counted the number of records you've played on recently. I don't know who it was, but I know the number is 18,585. How is that even possible?
I know. Someone asked me that too. When I was younger, every day you'd wake up and you look in your daily planner and you would go from one studio to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And that's just how life was. And that's, that mentality has stayed with me.
But very, very rarely do I tell an artist no when they ask me to play, because I just love playing. And
that's, as I said, I'm a worker bee. So to play on records and not even be the producer, to just be a side person I love that job.
Well, I can add to the answer in a way, because a friend of mine is about to release a record by a young artist called Alexander Bone, and you're on that record. Yeah. So you met at a session, he sent you a record, and then I think a couple of weeks later he got guitar stems in his email.
Right.
And he was like, I was blown away. Now Nile Rodgers is on my record. So maybe that's another way you've done it. You're very generous in that respect.
I'm always seduced by artistic prowess or interest, or like the same way now that I'm attached to Remy Wolf. She just blew me away. I was like, how do I say no? Even though I kept saying no, I was like, why do you want anyone else involved in your stuff? Because it's genius. Like, what do you do? I mean, it's already cool. Like, what do you do?
Well, look, Nile, as far as the art of longevity goes, I think you've got it mastered, and I think there's more to come. So I really look forward to it. Maybe we can do a part two somewhere down the line.
Yeah, I'd love to. This has been fun.
After you've done Chic the Musical, come on and be a guest on part two.
You got it, my friend.
Thanks, Nile. Take care,
man. Cheers.